Pints in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Tony is still recuperating, and Sean McNally is at it again with me. It's wonderful to have him on this this program here. And we have today one of the gentlemen, the only gentleman that we could really use in the 80s for equipment rentals, because he was the only guy in town with a pager. Remember that, you people? You people out there, pagers were the thing. We didn't have phones, cell phones. We didn't have internets, but the pager was the big deal. And Aldo had a pager. He ran around Boston and serviced all the clubs. And then he was also playing bass in a group called Iron Sausage. But let's start off with Aldo, the rental guy and stuff. And whatever.
It's all right, man.
Welcome, Aldo. And welcome, Sean.
Thank you very much, Dinky. It's really glad to hear from you, man. I'm how's your daughter? Remember, we used to help her move out of her dorm in those summers. Remember those summers?
Oh,
we
yeah.
We helped your daughter move in Harvard.
Well, she graduated from Harvard. She went to work at Stanford University.
Congratulations, Dinky. You got to be proud, man. I know you're proud.
I'm proud. Listen to this. What kind of phone do you use, Aldo?
I got an Android.
Oh,
Why am I not?
Okay, well, she works for Apple. She's the program coordinator for Apple Maps. And she did.
Oh, that's a good gig, man.
And she did the dark mode on Apple. And she did the AirTag, which is wonderful for us guys. I mean, it's absolutely the best thing that came out, is being able to put a little tag into all your gear and know where it is when it's traveling.
Believe you, man. I'm proud of you. I'm glad you're proud of her, man. That sounds like a really good gig. I'm happy for her.
She,
I know she don't remember me, but tell her and tell Tony I said hello too.
Oh God, definitely.
I haven't seen Tony since Nantucket.
Well, he's down on the Cape and is recuperating from his illness, and he's got the same as your best friend, which is Chris Doherty.
Right.
And he's recovering the same way, but a little bit harder hit him, and so it's going to be a while. But he's doing well.
You're going to give him my regards, correct?
Oh, yes. Definitely. Come on, Aldo.
All right.
You were the main guy, man, that I inherited from Andrew, but it was a good inheritance because you were on call 24/7. And for the people who don't know what that means out there, it means that this guy traveled in and out of every club in town, took other people's equipment to rent, but also went to Wurlitzer's rental, and got brand new equipment for people. Like,
I had a good relationship with Billy Murray. Remember him?
Oh, yeah. So let's start from the beginning. Sean, you can start and ask him a question, Aldo, from the beginning, and how he started and the whole nine yards, because he's still playing with Iron Sausage, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, it's good. It's good to catch up. I think a lot of the Boston scene will definitely know the name Aldo. Like Dickie just referenced, lots of clubs, lots of bands getting gear when that was really not a thing. You didn't create the industry, but you really took advantage of it at the time because you were, as Dickie said, the first guy to have a pager. And then I think he told me yesterday, even the first guy to have a cell phone back then.
That's right. And I got to tell you, a cell phone doubled my income. I got to tell you, man.
I bet. Let's go back a little bit, like Dickie said. Let's go back before you kind of fell into the scene. You were at Berkeley, and you graduated from Berkeley in '83, which I had no idea until we talked yesterday, which is outstanding.
Yeah. I never knew that.
Well, here's what happened. I worked for a man named Jim Mavrikos, who was a Harvard graduate, and he had gone to Harvard with a guy named Al Heyman. I don't know if you guys remember Alan Heyman.
Yeah,
he was a promoter around here. He did all the soul shows. But Don Law owned every venue or controlled every venue except Berkeley. So we started doing shows in there, and those bands rented everything. It was all a lot of like Motown acts like Temps and Tops, Gladys Knight. You know, that's how I got my start working for Al Haymon. You know, he's managing Floyd Mayweather Jr. now. That's his gig. He was from Cleveland originally, so I figured he's working for Don King, even though Don King is not allowed in any arena in America, I don't think, anymore.
Right.
But Al Haymon's kind of his man and manages Floyd Mayweather. He was a very successful, very capable guy, Al Haymon, but he promotes soul shows back in the day. And the only venue he could work at was Berkeley.
Wow.
So I was in a Berkeley band with the guys on the stage crew. We were all stagehands at Berkeley Performance Center. And we used to keep our gear under the stage because the stage was hollow. And so they go, well, we need this, this, and this. We just drag it over under the stage and go, here you go, $500. But the thing is, there was nothing but musicians all over the place, and they would do shows at Berkeley. We'd do a lot of school shows. And, as a matter of fact, I think I worked 1,000 shows before I even left school as a lighting guy, a spotlight operator. I became a very good spotlight operator. And so I know all these guys that had Prophet Fives, Boogie, Mesa Boogies, this, that, the other thing. So there really was nothing I couldn't get.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Stuff you rented out, was it actually like Berkeley gear? You just basically repurposed it to say, hey, I'll get the gear for you.
They belonged to students. But every once in a while, I would go to like the percussion department. Like Gladys Knight, man, for instance, wanted to rent timpanis, you know, like all kinds of stuff. And I would sometimes go to the school for that, make sure the school made money, but put it on stage, bring it back, you know.
Yeah.
But that's where I met Doug Doobie, you know.
Yeah.
Wow.
Organs.
Doug Doobie was my mentor in the band.
That's awesome. You said while you were in Berkeley, you actually were playing in a band, correct?
Yes, I was playing in a band we were called the Unction Brothers, and we used to practice on a stage at the Berkeley Performance Center. That was our practice room until we got our own house on Mission Hill.
Wow.
That's awesome.
That is.
You could afford Mission Hill back then, not now. That was crazy.
Yeah. You know, it was $1,500 a year back then. I think it's like $30,000 now. It's like 20 times that.
Yeah,
my daughter had an apartment there for Northeast. She's graduated from Northeast, right? There were five girls, and they all paid $1,500 each a month. $7,500 a month for one floor of a three-decker. Although, think about that now. What you could have bought back in those days.
Oh, my
right?
God.
I had an apartment on Newbury Street. My rent was $150 a month. There was three of us, $450 on Newbury Street. 273 Newbury Street.
Wow. Unbelievable.
So
obviously we're trying to focus on channel stuff. Now you got into the channel because at the time, you're talking about 83, 84, Andrew Arsenal was pretty much the stage manager running production, and then Warren Scott was the agent, the book agent, was for the entire time essentially. And
that's right.
They needed some gear, right? So tell us how that relationship kind of started.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, I started working on Lansdowne Street. I started doing the Kiss parties because they started on Lansdowne Street. Remember the Kiss 108 parties?
Yeah, the Metro. Sure.
On Lansdowne Street. And that was a band gear extravaganza. It was nothing but rentals. I remember the Gap Band was crazy. I'd make like $7,000 a weekend on those Kiss shows. Yeah. And that was a lot of money back then.
Oh,
and Andy Arsenal was hanging around Lansdowne. That's how I got my nickname, Aldo, from Carmine Sicardo and Tommy Moore, who was the Cars sound man.
Oh,
I used to work with those guys. And they're the ones that named me Aldo. And, you know, like any nickname that sticks, it's got the stupidest backstory ever. I don't even really want to go into it. But it has to do with TV commercials that no one remembers. And they were just goofing on me and breaking my balls. If you sorry. This is like a non-profanity.
No, you can swear, feel free.
But you know, that's how I got to know Andy, and I also got to know Timmy McKenna, remember from the Paradise?
Sure,
and I got to know all those guys from Lansdowne Street.
So you were really like the go-to guy for almost every venue in town at that point.
Yep.
Like I said, my mentor, Doug Doobie, he worked all of New England. But all I ever wanted to do was the clubs. I wanted to stay in town and do the clubs. And that's kind of why I got out of the business, because I had to go. When the channel closed and night stage closed, those clubs were my bread and butter, baby. And I had to go farther and farther afield to make money. And, you know, when say you're doing a gig in Maine. You got to bring kind of two of everything in case something blows up. You ain't going to go back and come back and the show will be still going on, you know. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
It was tougher to make money. I know it might sound like sour grapes now because Andy Bergson put me and Doobie out of business, I got to say. But the guy had to charge three times as much or else it wasn't worth it for him. And it wouldn't have been worth it for me either. But I like working.
So you were Doug Doobie. He was with B3 Rentals, correct, back then?
Doug Doobie was B3 Rentals. He had, I think, a dozen B3s and like 20 Leslies.
Wow.
Remember he had one that he painted white just for the Beach Boys?
Yeah.
Remember that?
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. That was a very smart business to get into at the time, though, because there really was no one else doing that kind of stuff.
Well, he was an awesome B3 player, Doug. Doug could play the shit out of that stuff.
Yeah, he's good.
And the day I met him, we were doing John McLaughlin at Berkeley, and he brought down a B3. And the drummer for the opening act, his name was Tommy Campbell, and he was a teacher at Berkeley for a lot of years. He goes, "Hey, man," and Doug's like a little guy. He's like 5'1", showed up in a T-shirt with like a two-day beard. But he goes, "Give me some Jimmy Smith," and he fucking, you know, and he nailed it. You know, like Doug could play, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he could play.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. So you're kind of like an independent guy out doing your own thing. You're working with Doug, but you also had your own thing going on where you became friendly, obviously, with a lot of local bands, local venue contacts, like you said, Timmy McKenna on Lansdowne and Andrew at the channel. And
right.
So your name got out there pretty quickly. And then, you know, everybody really became knowing that you were the guy to get to. You were the guy to cut. Anybody need something last minute, whether, oh, Christ, something just broke, or, hey, this guy needs a new keyboard, they're coming into town tonight. You were the guy that kind of got the scramble and made it happen.
Yeah, I had contacts. You want to hear a story about a really short notice gig at the Rat? This is kind of a funny story if you want to hear it. I don't know.
Yeah,
go ahead.
All right, so I'm living in a crib in Chelsea. I got a lot of my gear there. And I'm taking a bath, and Jimmy Harrelson, the Rat, calls me. And he says, "Rick Derringer's playing there that night." Remember Rick Derringer? Yeah, of course you do.
Yeah.
And a lot of times in the band gear business, you don't get shows, you don't get gigs because the opening act will supply the gear. I've done that myself a couple times. I opened for Sly and the Family Stones just because I had band gear at Jonathan Swift's. But anyway, he says the bass amp's not good enough for Rick Derringer, the headliner. Can you bring down an SVT? You know, an Ampeg SVT. And I climbed out of the tub, and I was from Chelsea to the Rat in 40 minutes with that SVT, right? Okay, yeah. But anyways, but the thing about that show was, even though Rick Derringer's really great, he looked like he'd been up for days, but that didn't diminish his talent. That guy could play, man. And and I remember there was more people on stage than there were in the audience that night.
I believe
so. At the end of the night, Jimmy Harold says, and this ain't even his club. This is Mitch's club. Downstairs was Mitch's club.
Before Jimmy bought him out, right? Because didn't Jimmy buy him out eventually?
Oh, no. Oh, no, no.
Mitch was the audience.
Mitch put it in his will to his kids to never sell Jimmy Harold.
Really?
That's right.
It's breaking news. Interesting.
Interesting.
That's crazy.
Ah. I don't know. I don't know if they worked something out eventually. But Mitch and Jimmy sometimes didn't see so eye to eye, and I really loved Mitch, man. I thought Mitch was an awesome guy.
He's a sweetheart. I mean, he's a sweetheart if you knew him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, if you knew him, right? He was a scary looking guy, and I think he was a little mobbed up at his time. I don't know.
I don't know either. I heard that Jimmy was renting the Rat was called something different before the Rat. I think it was TJ's. I think it was called maybe TJ's.
Yeah, that was before my time, man. I went to Jimmy Harold's wake. I know that.
That was the last time I saw you before we talked yesterday. It's been a while.
Great. Anyways, at the end of the night, Jimmy goes, "Listen, Aldo, the show didn't do so good, you know, because I wanted $75. I was there in 40 minutes." And he goes, "The show didn't do so good. Can you take a little less?" And he goes, "Jimmy, what if the show did really good? You going to pay me more?" "No,
right.
Of course not."
Right.
That's my life.
She's not easy to carry around either. That's
oh, he's heavy, man. You know, yeah.
Yeah, no question. Wow.
The bass amp I have now is a Ace, is an Acoustic 371. Do you guys remember that?
Yep.
It's a 370 head and a 301 cabinet.
Exactly.
It was acoustic solid-state version of the SVT, but you carry it. You carried the head in one hand and dragged the cabinet behind you with the other.
Yeah,
wow. And it sounded so awesome. It's the best soul bass amp ever made. And the thing about SVTs is that if you put them in a club, you really can't hear those tens. Those tens travel so far onto the audience, you have to be halfway through the rack to even hear what it sounds like. So a lot of these guys that play bass on SVTs, they don't even know what they have, and they keep turning it up because they can't hear it. But it's just the tens putting the sound past them. Am I wrong, Dinky?
Yeah. I had an acoustic. I had an acoustic with the Birds. Played the bass on the Birds with one of them acoustic 360s. We went all over the world.
Yeah, I had acoustic 360. Acoustic made good amps, man. I'm sorry you're out of business. But I got one of the old ones, the integrated, their answer to the SVT.
Yeah, they're good. But actually, if your SVT was a really good bass amp for a good theater, I mean, because it's still one of my favorite sounds, especially the B-15.
SVT? SVT is the industry standard. It still is.
It is. And if you noticed that, well, my original sound system, if you noticed, there was two cabinets with four tens in each, and there was four aside, and that really nice warm bass about a mile away.
Eight tens is a good setup. Eight tens is always a good setup. Remember, Ampeg would make it series and for the series the 2/4s and then parallel both. Yeah. Never mind. It's way too technical. I'm very sorry. When I start talking, being
I know you've been wanting to catch up with Dinky for a long time, so feel free to share stories away. It's good to listen to it.
Well, let's listen to some channel stories. Some channel stories, because you have definitely more than just bringing gear there. You played bass with Iron Sausage. You had a great night with the guys, with the Gangarine guys, and playing with you.
You know, we almost didn't make that show because we had to go down and get the gear down to the South End. And that day they had a Puerto Rican parade.
Oh,
you remember those?
I remember.
And they put their flags on the windshield wipers and made them go up and down stuff. So we had to go talk to the cops and stuff. He says, we got to go in there and get our stuff. We got a show. You know, our band's got a show. We got to be there in an hour because it was an afternoon show. I mean, we opened for the BH Surfers, right?
Yeah. That's right, Sean.
Chris last week, exactly.
Yeah, it's right. And so the cop says, what's the name of your band? And I didn't want to tell him I had a sergeant. He just goes, IS. And he goes, all right, get in there. Get the fuck out of here. Go, just get your stuff and go. And they cleared a way for us. We made it there right on time. It was crazy.
Well, that was you. You never knew at one point that I always remember you coming late to with a bunches of keyboards, the same keyboard, because you were doing it for a reggae act. The guy didn't want to change presets, so he had to get five keyboards or something stupid of the same thing.
I put up a Prophet 5 for some reggae band? It was at the channel, and the guy put tape over the word Prophet.
Yeah.
And he goes, I goes, what are you taping up my thing for? He goes, there's only one Prophet, man. I go, and I own it, so.
I love the Prophet. That's awesome. That is awesome.
I love it.
The bands are very particular about their stuff and didn't want to do too much sometimes. That's funny.
So tell Aldo, tell us something about the stories. Not when you were doing work or anything, but you were actually come to see a band play or come to see musicians, whether it be their friends or people like...
Well, I was going to ask you one question, Dickie. There was one question I wanted to ask you. Remember Devo played there?
Yeah.
Okay, the bass player, his name was Jerry Casale. I was talking to Sean about this. He was supposed to be like my doppelganger. When he came in, did you go, hey, Al, what are you doing here? Did you actually say that to him? Someone told me you said that. It's not true, right?
Probably.
That's a great story. I love it.
You remember my first wife, Danielle, right? Remember her?
I think I do. I didn't know you.
Yeah, you do. I know you do. But she says, that fucking guy looks just like you, Aldo. If you weren't standing here right now, I'd actually, I've noticed him on videos and stuff, and I guess he looks like me, but I don't know what I look like.
I probably did say that, because you were completely different, the way you brought yourself in, the way you sneaked around, the way everything was done the right way. I'm saying, this is Aldo there. That was cool, and he did the same thing. I said, oh, there's his... I'm saying to myself, well, Aldo got a brother.
he did look something like me. I mean, he was an Italian guy, for one thing, so...
Yeah.
I don't know, but... let me think of some of the shows I did there. I remember Devo did a really good show. Remember they played a video at the beginning of their show where they were doing Are You Experienced? They had a video for Are You Experienced, and they made Jimi Hendrix come out of a coffin and everything like that. Yeah. It was a crazy show. But I played there with a ska band. I don't know if you were there that night. I know Tommy Bracey was there. Remember Tommy?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I played there with Mr. Cranky one time for New Year's Eve.
That must have been before. I didn't get there till 86 to work. And
no, this is after. This is in the 90s game. It was the late 90s. This is after Daniel tossed me, and I moved to Davis Square, and I met up with these ska guys. Yeah. I had quit smoking for 3 years, and those guys made me start up again. It's
so nerve-wracking. but that's what happens with the reggae. You get the vibe, man. And then you have a good old time, and you feel good. And do you know what it is? It's the bass. You need the bass in reggae. You need the bottom end. You need to feel every single note. And that's why...
Well, with that ska band, I was playing B3, man.
They're playing B3, so then they're doing...
They already had a bass player. There's these two cousins that ran the band, a guitar player and a bass player. So he goes, well, I still had the B3. I still got it. It's in my apartment right now. I'm leaning on it right now. I got the B3 and Leslie right here.
A Doug Doobie special, eh?
No, I got it at Wurlitzer's. I got it at Wurlitzer's in 1984.
Good for you.
For $1,400.
That's cool.
Leslie Benson pedals, too.
That's the good setup.
It was a good setup. You know, it's a 1960, I found out.
Wow.
I'm really proud of it.
That tone is wonderful on that stuff. Doug Doobie, you know... I had the sound company out in Lenox, Mass, and one day we had to do a B3 rentals, and he came out to do it. Well, the thing was real interesting because he didn't want the money. He wanted this dog he found.
He wanted his what?
He wanted a dog. He took a dog home instead of the money. That's Doug.
I can see that, man.
You can't see. That's what I was waiting for.
That's how good that thing's running. How's that? There you go. I'm so embarrassed now. Anyway, I was trying to start it up and play it for you guys, but the Leslie cable has to be adjusted for us sometimes.
Yeah,
it's so old, and it's gigged like 100 times maybe, that B3.
Well,
I remember... bringing it up and down stairs.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah.
I wouldn't use a flight kit. Well, the thing's like 300 pounds, right? B3, and if you put a flight case on it, that makes it 400.
Earlier than you in 1968-69, I had a roommate called Baz, and Baz used to work with the Nice, which is Keith Emerson at the time, and what have you.
Yeah, the Nice.
So his B3s were just outrageous. But the best one out of the English lot was Yes's B3. It was a cut in half. And they left half of it in a truck one day, and I got it.
Well, how about Stevie Winwood when he played Great Woods? He bi-amped it. He routed out the bottom of the B3, the bottom of the Leslie, put an 18 in there, and bi-amped it with a Crown 150 on top and a 300 on the bottom.
There you go.
It was so loud they had to wrap a curtain around it before he went on stage.
But it sounded good. You've got an old one. The warmth, the feeling you get from the old Leslie, the feeling you get from the actual B3 sounds itself on the old 60s ones.
Well, there's nothing digital about it. It's all electronic. It's not even analog.
It's all beautiful. It's beautiful. Then the Korg came out with their B3 thing, and it's only... I'm saying, what's that? Don't give me that, whoa, that sound. And it gives me that sound. I'm going like, no, I don't want that. I want to feel it, you know?
You know, my sister got a settlement of like several $1,000. And she goes, where am I going to hide this cash? He goes, put it in the back of the fucking B3, man. No one's ever going to get
that. Plenty of room.
And so she did, yeah.
I used to hang on
her money for it.
So let's give some channel stories, because you got so many.
I know you played. You played the channel with Iron Sausage, and you also were in the band Left Nut for a while. Another really funny band around town.
That Left Nut.
The Norm is a singer, and I'm going out to see him in San Diego in October. Norm, I haven't seen him in a while. He got in an argument with his bass player in the studio, and the guy walked out, and so he called me. They had a gig the next day or the next night. And he goes, Aldo, I'm in trouble. I goes, yeah, man, come on, I'll go. I goes, I don't know how long I can stay with the band, but, you know, I would be glad to. And I still got that bass, that blue bass that I played right inside.
Oh, yeah, that
Kubicki factor bass.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that thing's worth money now, man. I got Billy Murray gave it to me for ultimately $500, that bass. It was $1,500, but he said it was the demo model, so it was chipped. And he goes, give me $1,500, I'll give you 1,000 free rentals. And I was so busy back them days, I used it up in like 8 days. I really got it for $500. It's worth about $4,000 now. But anyway, so Norm goes, yeah, could you play bass for us? And I remember practicing that day and playing that night, and I was really proud of myself that I didn't let my old pal down, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt good about that, you know, left nut. I don't think we ever played the channel, but we played around a lot of gigs. A lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah, Grease, Eddie's parties. Oh, yeah, no question. That was a fun band, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, Norm was a great front man, man. It always mystified me. And I told you this on remember when we were talking in that old phone call? And it always mystified me that people, when they're in a band with a good front man, they think it's still their band. It's never their band. It's always the front man's band. Yeah. And your job is to always make them sound good. That's your only job. Yes. Make the front man sound good.
That's exactly right.
No, it's a good way to take it, because like you say, a lot of guys think they are the show, so to speak. But you know, when you have a qualified, outstanding frontman that really is the face of the band,
they're irreplaceable.
Perfect. Yeah, definitely perfect.
Like in other words, their bass player was very replaceable because they got me. How replaceable can you get? not the frontman, you know?
Yeah.
Not the frontman.
No.
And these guys wrote all the songs. They played guitars. And I goes, it's not your band. It's his band. As soon as you swallow that and make him sound good, then success will, you know. Do you agree? Yes, you must agree.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I agree with you, for sure.
Yes,
it takes a team, right? But as far as the front man is typically the face, that's what they call the front man.
Your most valuable asset. I always thought.
So you were doing the gear for quite a while. They said the channel closed, Night Stage closed, and then. You maybe had to shift around a little bit. You were playing in bands at the time, and then when you sold the business, I want to hear about your business card your mom made. This is awesome.
Oh, yeah. She goes, I go, you know, I'm tired of saving all these people's asses. You know, like, they're calling me up last minute. I'm always, like, running around. And so she made me business cards that said, saving your ass since 1980. My mom made me those. And I love my mom. She's been dead a long time, you know. God bless her. I still think about her, you know.
That's
my
awesome.
Mom loved me. Oh, my mom loved me.
She did. That's such a great. I'm just so happy that she picked up the actual tagline.
Yeah, it was right. She designed the cards herself. They were yellow. It was a nice script. It was beautiful. She had a lot of class, my mom.
I know. I can tell you. I have one somewhere. I know I have your business card somewhere. I kept so much stuff from back then. I know I saw it in one of my moves in the last 2 decades. I know it's somewhere in my collection, which I'll have to pull out someday and send you a picture of, because that was awesome. That was so funny.
Well, you know, I'm going to
the front of the card. What the name? What was the name of your business on the front of the business card?
Aldo Bandier. I had T-shirts. Remember Dinky?
Yeah.
It had Aldo Bandier on the front and a dollar sign on the back.
Yeah. That's right. I remember that one. Oh, my goodness.
You know, Dickie Barrett told me, because, you know, I made friends with Dickie. I knew his older brother first. All those guys, Chris, Springer, Dickie Barrett, I knew all their older brothers before I knew them. But Dickie told me he was over in England one time, and some English guy had an Aldo Bandier T-shirt. He goes, hey, that's a friend. Where'd you get that shirt? Dickie, man, he's always defending me. Dickie Barrett was always defending me.
Yeah,
I think he thought I needed defending, and I'm glad. I love him for that.
Yeah.
So eventually, your reign, so to speak, as the gear lord around Boston kind of – you know, you can see the kind of writing on the wall. Some bigger companies are trying to come in and take away the business. So you ended up selling your business to Capron, right? Is that what it was?
I sold a lot of it to Capron. I sold my good drums, the Yamaha recording kit and the DWs, to them. I sold a lot of stuff to Kevin Gary. Remember Kevin Gary?
Oh, yeah.
The Christian guy. He was like a minister and stuff like that. Oh, what a great guy. Oh, he's such a great guy. You know, when I got out of the business,
is he still doing that?
Is
he still doing that? Kevin Gary is still doing that?
I don't know. He was older than me, so he's got to be pushing 80 now, Kevin Gary.
Oh, wow. Well,
I'm 70 now. I'm 70, baby.
You're still a punk.
Yeah, punk at heart for sure, right?
Oh, Aldo.
Thank you, man. I'm so glad to hear your voice, man. I'm so glad.
It's the same to hear yours.
In fact, Aldo, we were talking today. You were really looking forward to catching up with Dinky. It's been quite a while. I mean, I knew you had a couple. I know you mentioned the Debo Jerry Casal story.
Oh, yeah. Great,
but
yeah.
The other thing you wanted to share with, don't feel free to go offline. If you guys want to chat, you know, make up a couple questions from him.
I got one more question, Dinky. You know, I used to watch the Beatles on the roof at Let It Be on the Apple Building. Were you on that roof?
No, you got that from AJ. AJ went around the room talking about that. No, I was down in London doing with Fleetwood Mac at that time, but not on top of the.
Building that day. No, okay.
No, we go downstairs.
I wanted to believe it. That's for sure.
Well,
I'd watch videos and I go, where the fuck is he? He's got to be up there somewhere.
We go down to the Beatles studio. I mean, Mick went down one day with Peter and Danny, and as they walked in the door, Danny Kerwin and Peter Green, as Peter just went through the door, the first thing that came out of Paul McCartney's thing was "Here Comes the Sun King," and that was based on Peter Green. And if you really listen to that album, it's all Fleetwood Mac. You listen to the sounds of the guitar. You listen to how it's played. You listen to the parts like what we had in Albatross, which was what Peter Green. See, them guys were very smart on how they did stuff. And emotionally, all the time, they put their heart into it. And that's why they were so
Peter Green and Jeremy Spencer were so concerned with their own sound, the way they sounded.
Oh, totally, totally.
They would do takes just based on sound, from what I understand. And they changed the way guitars sounded from then on.
Well, Jeremy changed the bottleneck, you know, from the guys in Chicago. We did an album in Chicago with them and stuff. And with Marshall Chess. And it was Fleetwood Mac in Chicago with all the guys, Sammy Nicks, the big bass player. He looked after Peter when Peter went to a Southside club to play,
bass and drums they were both goony looking guys. They were monstrously tall but really scrawny.
It was wonderful going through airports when Jeremy was running through Mick's legs and the two balls would hit him in the neck. it was incredible going on airplanes. You wouldn't believe it. We haven't thrown off, but we were. The actions that were definitely band style, let's put it that way. But we want to talk about you. That's 60s and 70s. But I want to talk about you. You came up into Berkeley. You were originally born.
I got there in 78. I got to tell you, man, that summer, I knew I had to get out of. I'm from Worcester. I grew up in Worcester.
I knew I had to
get out of town. And I wrote a lot of letters that summer. To try to get grants and stuff, and I ended up leading league in financial aid. And can I tell you a story of how I got on that stage crew?
Yeah.
Maybe. Yes.
Okay. I don't want to say this woman's whole name, but her first name was Linda. Okay. And she was in charge of work study. Work study's part of your financial aid package, right?
Yeah.
And I was getting a free ride anyways, but the work study. But she sent me over to Berkeley Performance Center, which I found out later was by far the best job. In the work study universe at Berkeley. And when I got there, I noticed that there was a lot of kind of good looking, smart ass guys there. And it turns out she was sending her favorites over there. And a couple of those guys had been with her. You know what I'm saying? Like she was picking her favorites and sent them to the good job. And I felt very blessed because, Linda picked me, you know, it's nice. You know, it made me very cocky eventually. I got to tell you.
That explains it.
Explains everything. I got by on my looks. I'm such an ugly man now. I'm such an ugly man now. I had to grow a beard. That's how ugly I am.
I can see you in a beard. That's funny. That's cool.
I got a crazy story about Berkeley, and it's kind of sexual. I don't want you guys getting kicked off YouTube or anything.
Feel free, right?
Feel free. Okay. I got there, all right, 1980, they started the Boston Globe Jazz Festival, right?
Yeah.
And it started at Berkeley, at that venue, and they would have one or two prestige concerts at Symphony Hall.
Yeah.
Okay, and the very next year, 1981, we had a lot of piano players playing that week at Berkeley for Boston Globe, like Bill Evans, McCoy Tyner, some real heavies.
Yeah.
Bill Evans was awesome that week. But they rented a Bösendorfer piano.
Yeah.
You know what that is?
Oh, yeah.
It's a German made. It's like, it was worth $75,000 back then. It was like 11 and a half feet long. It had 94 keys. Well, all the ushers were girls, and a few of us like took turns on the piano with these girls.
We tuned up.
I don't want to say I was one of them, but you know,
we had two Bösendorfers in the studio with Steely Dan. And which one was better than the other? It was like
awesome pianos, man.
They're so good, but you know, they were really
just like a German, you know, that much better. And like, and now I'm holding my hands out wide. That much more expensive.
Oh yeah.
Germans operate. Yeah.
Yeah, and heavy son of a guns. Oh, let me tell you, heavy sons of guns. The frame.
Right, they, man, what a sound. Oh, God.
Oh, the dynamics.
11 feet long. Come on. They were crazy big.
Yeah. Yeah. So at the end of the day, you couldn't take them in the channel to trash them. I mean, you get Jerry Lee Lewis jumping on the top of the hair thing, freaking out. You know?
Oh, remember that time I rented that piano to Jerry Lee, the Baldwin?
Yeah.
At the channel?
Yeah.
And I was afraid he was going to, like, take the crap out of it. And I go, so I didn't say it was brand new because that might have egged him on. And I didn't want to say it had been beaten up. So I said, it's only been used once. And that seemed to, like, calm him down, you know?
Yeah.
That seemed to calm him down.
Yeah.
You were doing all these shows around Boston, but you also had a couple of instances where you did go on the road a little bit in the Northeast, at least. Some of the oldie shows you talked about. You said you were at Herbie.
I made some contacts at Berkeley from Jazz Soy. You put together the band gear, and then you go on the road with that band gear, and you look after it. You know, you set up the drums. You kind of do the roadie bit, but it's your gear.
Yeah.
So I did Grover Washington. I did Herbie Hancock. And the last band I toured was called Alien Sex Fiend. Remember him?
Yep. No. Remember them.
Alien Sex Fiends.
I don't remember them.
That was taken away from you had a lot of steady work back in the city, though, so it was kind of hard to get away and go on the road for that long.
It was, because I was still working as a stagehand. And, you know, as a spotlighter, but, you know, I always wanted a union card, like an IATSE card. You know how valuable that is, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought I was good enough with a spotlight to be able to, because when they do ice shows, like the Ice Capades and stuff like that, they would scrape the bottom of the barrel, and they would eventually call me, because I could run those old carbon arc spots, Troopers and Super Troopers, and I could maintain them, you know, so I'd get those gigs, but they wouldn't give me a union card to save my life or any of the old Berkeley guys. And I always thought, because they knew I was running rackets and you know, IATSE's always running rackets, but I was working at the Opera House. You know, I did 11 operas for Sarah Caldwell. Remember her?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Oh, yeah.
I did 11 operas for her, big time opera. And, we did a revival of something called Man of La Mancha, a Broadway musical.
Yeah, yep.
But it was one of the original cast, and they were Guild. So IATSE was out in front picketing us.
Wow.
And they said, and we're walking into work, and he goes, you guys are working for substandard wages. And all of us goes, give us union cards. We'll walk off the goddamn job right now. They go, well, we can't do that. You know? Well, sorry, guys. You got to go to work now, you fucking asshole. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you deserve union money, but how about us? I actually was very closed back then in the 80s, man. I actually was very wrapped up, sewed up, as they say.
Yeah, definitely.
It's tough to get in.
Well, the Jones family and the Higgins family from South Boston ran the whole union.
Complex.
Politics.
Yeah, complex.
Politics, baby.
Politics.
I believe in nepotism. To an extent, but not not to the point of like turning down real talent like myself.
No,
so you sold off your gear in the late '90s, and then you had a quote unquote corporate job with the 401 last 25 years. You're going to be retiring soon, though.
I'm retiring at the end of this year, I just wanted to get my 401k up where I could still save money, and it's going to work out now. You know, it's, I was just talking to my sister about it. She's got a life insurance policy. He goes, the only reason I didn't get a life insurance policy is because I got the 401k. They were really good to me. They were. But I'm glad to be gone. I'm trying to write fiction. Did you know that, Dinky? How about that?
Yeah, that sounds good. You could go plenty.
Yeah, plenty. Yeah, I got an idea for a story about two teenage girls that decided to be burglars. I'm working on it now. You know what the toughest part about writing fiction to me is the dialogue. Dialogue's tough. But it gives me an excuse to talk to myself.
I love it.
I wrote French from the Boston scene. Johnny Barnes did a couple books out there. And even like Gary Summers, he's got a couple plays and things you've been written.
Gary well. Summers, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
He wrote plays?
Absolutely.
I didn't know that. Wow.
I'll give you his number if you don't have it after the call. Yeah, no, for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, he's a bunch of stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I did that with Carter. I did that, the Life on the Road with Carter, and only covered up until 1979 from the 60s.
How'd it come out?
It came out, it was on Billboard. It came out in 98. And then it's now out of print.
It's out of print?
Oh, yeah, and everything. But we're just about to do, I would say later this year, we're doing I'm finishing off the audio book of that.
Tell me the title. I want to buy it. I'm going to try to hunt it down.
It's Life on the Road, The Incredible Rock and Roll Adventures of Dinky Dawson. And it's
I finally picked up a copy on eBay about a month ago. So they're out there. You can find about 20, 25 bucks, hopefully. Otherwise, there's some really expensive ones, but you can get one.
A bargain at twice the price.
And Carter Allen wrote it with me because he's really knows his stuff about.
Not he was a good writer.
Just about Boston, but about all the things that were happening in the world at that time in respect of the music side of things. What bands?
Yeah, that's really the reason I'd probably want to buy it. Like I'm going to find it, Dink. Yeah. So it's Life on the Road, Dinky Dawson, right?
On the Road, The Incredible Rock and Roll Adventures of Dinky Dawson.
I'll remember it. I swear.
And that's it. You can go onto the old website and check it out there.
I want that book.
Well, it's
Waldo, what are you going to call your own book when you write it?
Bridge Burner.
That's true, though. Bridge Running.
You like that?
Yeah.
Bridge Burner.
Yeah. I mean, you're into all that kind of stuff. The stuff that you did us. The stuff you did with us and the stuff that you did.
I never thought of myself as a bridge burner. You know, I still have my old friends. You know, I have enemies, of course, and some of them are formidable, which is complimentary, I guess. But the people I was friends with, I always stayed friends with, I'd like to think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see you as a. I'm actually it's a bridge, a unifier. You have a lot of friends in the business, and Burn it to me is like the opposite of how I pictured you. To tell you the truth, you know?
Well,
yeah.
I know bridge burners in my time, that's for sure.
And well, you've got Chris Doherty to help every day, and that kind of stuff is a biggie. You know, he gets his mind
he's
going.
He's connected, man. That kid's connected. He's respected and connected.
And he's really fighting to get what he wants to do. He's singing again. Writing again songs and all kinds of stuff, because he's good.
I want to write songs with him, because can I tell you an Iron Sergeant story? When I was living in Chelsea, we wrote the whole set in like, 4 hours. And so our plan was this, like we did that first gig at the channel, and then every other gig we'd come up with one cover, and let me see what some of the covers were, like Time Has Come Today. But we'd add, you know, we do the cover, and then we go into the eight song set. We never change the set ever. But we wrote all the songs in 4 hours, he and I.
I think he said when he's on his interview, he said you guys only played maybe a handful of shows, 8-10 shows, whatever. And he said every show after that Butthole Surface show is either your reunion,
or a breakup gig. Yeah,
that was it. That was what Chris said. I thought it was great. But you
need a breakup gig. That's perfect. It's
perfect. It's perfect. But yeah, you no messing around, Aldo. It was just great to have somebody on a page to be able to call at any time
and say, okay, these assholes want a pair of congas or something stupid.
Yeah, you know, and by that time I had my hands on everything. I owned the stuff. You know, I'd buy it over the years, and, you know, I felt kind of bad about dispersing all that stuff, but I hung on to what I can. I still got my bass, still got my guitar, and I still got the B3, yeah. Even though it upset me just now.
Well, they do that. I mean, when they hired Ambrosia out in '79, they came to my warehouse with the crew and ripped one of them a complete B3 apart and rebuilt it overnight and stuff. And we were off.
Wow.
Well, you know,
I mean, it would take more than 1 week.
Well, the guy's
complicated.
The guy was so technical, knew what he's doing. He's actually a master computer builder right now. And after all these years in Los Angeles.
Because, you know, you've seen the back of it. We've seen those things with the back off them.
The wiring.
It's a crazy amount of wires. It's 1,000 wires back there.
And it's crazy. You got to know where these ones go because they all do some of it.
I still oil it every 6 months. You know, I still got B3 oil. You have to oil it like a fucking car. It starts like a car.
Yeah,
because... Yeah. You play it all? No.
Yeah, I play let me see if I can get it.
It takes a while to fire up the fire up.
Yeah, no. So, yeah, it starts like a car. It's like got two switches. You go, and then you can hear it turning over,
and then click it on.
You wait till it gets up to a certain gear.
Yeah, and then you go boom.
There you go. But like I said, this thing's beat up, but it still plays like it's supposed to. I hope. Give me a second. You wreck.
This could be your first. Do an outro of your own music as you get off the air. That'd be awesome.
Maybe not today.
Not today.
That's too bad.
It sounds like it's on the fritz, but I'm so embarrassed now.
Don't be embarrassed. That's the fun stuff.
I admit there's dust on it.
Yeah, that's the fun stuff. You make songs up about that. My organ won't work anymore. What's the deal? Songs.
Oh, no. I know what I got to do. It was on short. It was too short a notice, I suppose.
Yeah, no, you get
Maybe I'll get on the show again and I'll play some songs.
Yeah, you get the hammer out and go boom. Stop.
When I was playing it like a while ago, I was working on Groove Holmes. He's like one of my favorites, Groove Holmes. You know what I mean? He's from the 60s. He was an excellent guy. There was a bar across the street from Berkeley called TC's Lounge. You don't remember that?
Yeah. Okay.
I do, yeah. Sure.
Getting burnt down.
Yes. Yeah. In the 80s or 90s, yeah.
Yeah, you remember TC's. They had that awesome jukebox and it had Count Basie on it and it had Groove Holmes, a couple songs by Groove Holmes. And like I got to know him and I really admire his music, you know. I like Groove Holmes.
That's awesome.
That's cool. That's cool. I'm still flabbergasted. You've got one of those real good organs from the 60s.
Real good. It doesn't sound real good at the moment, but I swear I'm going to work on it. I'll be done by the end of the day. You watch.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I'm so embarrassed. I'm so embarrassed that fucking went on the fridge.
It was not expected at all, Aldo. You could have
put me on the spot, man.
I like that one. So anyway, we've got like 5 minutes left today. We've got a shorter one than normal, but it's cool. What we're trying to do. It's cool. You're good, Aldo. It's really been a long time.
I hope I was a good guest, man. I really wanted to make this work. I'm so in love with you, Dinky. Sean, you're the best. You know, I didn't want to disappoint you. I just didn't.
You're not disappointing anybody.
Catch up with you. It's been quite a while. I mean, like I said, your name is out there. Anybody that bossed the music scene in the 80s, Aldo's name. And, you know, it's just good to catch up. So, I mean, like I say, you've been out of the business for probably, you know, almost 30 years now, and it's good to just kind of go back and reminisce. These calls and these interviews for Dinky's podcast is really just to kind of back and reminisce about, you know, what a great time it was. We didn't really quite realize at that time how lucky
days,
we were.
Baby. Oh, those were the days.
You know, how cheap it was and how you could go see bands every night of the week. And we all did that. And it was just, you know.
And everyone could afford everything, you know.
Yeah.
You just could afford stuff. You know, it's lovely talking to you guys about those days.
I remember you closing out one night with coming there and picking up all this rental. and then being there the next morning when we had to go out, we had an afternoon show and you got all rentals again for the afternoon. I'm saying, Aldo, did you sleep?
Well, you know, I'm going to tell you something that really made me decide to give it the business. And I'm glad I got a chance to say this at the end of this, is that I started to get really afraid of crowds. Like, yeah. I never was, but, all right, you know, the show would be over. I would always show up for the last few songs, you know, to rave ups. But then you got to wait through that crowd to get your gear. And back in the, you know, middle 90s, I started leaving the stuff overnight, which I don't feel back then was very professional. And I realized that I was starting to, crowds started to make me very nervous.
Yeah, yeah.
I still don't like them. No. You know, I don't know if that ever happened to you or anybody else, but crowds started to kind of freak me out. You know, it's not claustrophobia. I think it's more agoraphobia than anything. And, yeah. And it doesn't bother me now, but. It's also very daunting.
Think about that too. You're going from gig to gig to gig. So, you know, when people are winding down a show at the channel or anywhere, you know, if people kind of dilly dallying, hanging around, meeting other great people after the show, and then you want to tell them how to get to get to. You off the stage and get out of there. So I can see where it gets frustrating. People are all over the place, and you don't want to be a jerk off. It's like, yeah, my way, I gotta move. But you know,
I would never be that nasty. But like, I don't want to be touching a bunch of people. That's how it eventually became.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Didn't want to get jostled no more. I don't know what that had to do with anything, but it eventually happened to me. You know, and I guess it's agoraphobia, which I guess the Greek translation is fear of the marketplace. So, and I guess I have some version of agoraphobia from those days because waiting through those crowds got very difficult at the end.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Glad you did it for as long as you did it for, Aldo, because you helped a lot of us out for sure, and we all appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
I'm so in love with you too. I much appreciate it
after all these years and stuff. I still can't believe when I heard Chris talk about you last week. I just got off the phone with Aldo. Why not? Nancy and I, both of us freaked out. We said, what, Aldo's still here? I thought he'd gone.
Thought I was dead, didn't you, Nancy? I am not dead.
I instantly went back.
I own my own place in Cambridge. You know, I walk to work. It's an easy life. I have an easy life. A small life, but an easy one.
My God, that's
also,
cool.
Before we do hang out here, you did want to mention the other day. You tell me, you wouldn't mind getting a part-time gig in the business, so to speak, if there was something around, right? Took a few hours here and there?
Well, the thing is, I can't collect. If I could collect my 401k and still work there, I would do it, but they don't allow that, so... I'm going to try to find a third stream of income, and I'm still a good stagehand. I mean, I'm still pretty conscientious. I don't know about running a spot. I don't know if they, you know, there's no carbon ox. I'm sure I can run an incandescent, but no, I'm going to try to figure out a gig after I retire when I start collecting my, my pension. Yeah, that's right. I hope anyone's got a gig out there for Aldo. You know,
you
I promise I'll shut up every once in a while.
Yeah, we'll let Sean know that. We'll call out now. Has anybody got a gig for Gil?
Yeah, hook me up, guys. Come on. It's me.
Help Aldo out for a side gig here and there if you got any ideas. Just hit him up.
All right, here we go. I gotta close because it's time for us, unfortunately.
Someone loves you, Dinky.
We love you, Aldo. I'm glad you're playing with Chris. I'm glad you're working with Chris. You guys have a momentum going off that was really cool when Iron Sausage. I thought just that alone was really cool. All right, you guys.
I wish your daughter all the success in the world. I wish your daughter all the success.
I much appreciate it. I thank you. I'll let her know that. And I'll let Tony know.
Catch up, Aldo, buddy. We'll talk again.
All right, see you.
This is Two Pints in the Corner closing out.
Two Pints in the Corner. No podcast better than Two Pints in the Corner. All right, so long, guys.
Great, Aldo. Thank you, buddy.
Bye-bye. Thank you, Aldo.